For those who weren't here last night, I'm sorry you missed what was, I think, four most articulate speakers on a very complex subject with very, very different views. I commented this morning to Rav Shurlo. We were talking, you know, it was a dialogue, as Rav Shurlo explained it, I think. You know, everybody was respectful to each other. The fireworks didn't go between each other. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I really want to give a yasher kof to all the speakers, and it's a pleasure to have Dr. Unger with us, who'll speak right now. Just, you know, I'll briefly introduce him. Amiel Unger made Aliyah in 1978, lives in Tekoa. He has a bachelor's degree at Yeshiva University, received a master's and PhD at Columbia, taught political science at Bar-Ilan for 25 years. He's the foreign policy columnist on Makor Rishon, and he reads for Yediot Ahronot. He now writes the Jerusalem Post, the Muna magazine, and he writes a columnist in Haaretz. And it's a pleasure to have him, and Bakasha. You can have the first and the last word in this session. Yes.
Good morning, and my appreciation to all the people who went to Hashkama Minyan's and gave up their extra hour of sleep on the day that we can only find similar in Yom Ha'atzmaut on Independence Day, the one Sunday of the year that we get in Israel. So thank you for your sacrifice. I thank Torah and Moshe for the honor of speaking before you, given the illustrious people that you've assembled both in this session and in previous sessions. What I am going to try to do today is to explain why, in my opinion, the position of the religious Zionist camp has become stronger and is reflected in the greater robustness and stability of Netanyahu II as opposed to Netanyahu I, the previous attempt by Netanyahu to be prime minister from 1996 to 1999, reflecting changes in the religious alignment as well as in its relationship with other sectors in Israeli society. And this, despite the fact that the previous yardstick for measuring the strength of the religious camp in Israel in terms of political power, the number of seats held by the religious Zionist party, the number of seats has not since equaled the high achieved in the 1977 elections that brought the Likud and Menachem Begin to power for the first time. I'm going to start with two vignettes and then I'll try to weave them together. In Israel, in the last elections, a series of elections, there has always been a new flash party or a small party that has caught fire in the elections, which encourages people to try their luck. I mean, two elections ago, the stars were the Pensioners Party. Last time out, it was Lieberman's party, Yisrael Beiteinu, that surged. So therefore, while in Canada you could have the NDP surprising and displacing the Liberals, But this is a rare occurrence, whereas in Israel, you can have flash parties, and therefore there are two serious people waiting in the wings. One of them is television personality and columnist Yair Lapid, who has the media presence. He's also what you would describe as a hunk. And he is considering entering the political sweepstakes with his own list. And you also have the possibility of a political comeback by Aryeh Deri, who was the head of Shas up to 1999. Now, Lapid, who was the son of the late Tommy Lapid, Thomas Lempel in the old country, he has stated that he will not repeat the tactics of his father, Tommy Lapid, who used Haredi baiting and religious baiting as a way of winning the hearts of the Israeli voter. And he too, under Shinoy, was a flash party that surged and then came crashing down to oblivion by the time of the next elections. In the case of Deri, you have the ironical situation that in 1999, after Ehud Barak's victory, but also a tremendous success for the Shas party that won 19 seats in that 1999 elections, you had demonstrations in Tel Aviv that brandished the slogans Rak Lo Shas, just anybody but Shas. And Barak, who as usual is attentive to public opinion, promptly took Shas on board. And the reason why, you know, Deri was not acceptable because of the criminal charges against him, for which he served a prison sentence, and now he's free to run again. But here, the very same people said, anybody but Shas, anybody but Deri, now see Deri as the great white hope, the person who could possibly purloin seats from the Religious Nationalist Alliance and move them towards the center, meaning that he could be a factor in a coalition of the left. In other words, even people who 10 years back felt that they could dispense with the religious voter, now have come around to the point of view that they need religious votes. They need, in order for the political balance to change in Israel. Now, obviously, this is a factor of numbers. But it is also a factor, what is also a factor is that the religious voter and the religious politicians or the religious Jews in politics are coming to assume the same role that religious parties assumed in Western Europe, and to some extent is occurring also in terms of American politics. In Western Europe, you had a Catholic party called the Zentrum in Germany. A center party that, on the one hand, did not want the nationalist Protestant approach of Bismarck. On the other hand, it feared the socialists, so it occupied a place in the center. It was basically a defensive party trying to secure the interests of its constituents. After the Second World War, that party, in its reincarnation as the Christian Democrats, became the anchor of those voters in Germany who wanted more traditional family values, the values of religion, and they were more wary of, let's say, East Germany. The same thing occurred in Italy, where you had, before the fascist dictatorship, you had the Popolari, and after the Second World War, again, a Christian democracy that basically brought together people with more conservative values and religious values. This had not occurred in Israel, or there was a delay in this occurring in Israel for a couple of reasons. One, until 1977, there was what was called the hegemonia, the hegemony of the labor movement under Mapai, and therefore the only course for the religious party, if it wanted to defend the interests of its constituency, was to be a coalition member. Since 1977, with the advent of Likud to power, we now have a situation where there is alternation in Israeli politics. And already in the 1981 elections, religious voters, captivated by the more traditional values of Menachem Begin, deserted their own sectoral party and went over to vote for Likud. Then we had the rise of the Sephardic religious parties, the greater involvement of Agudat Yisrael in Israeli politics. But basically, we now had a situation where there was a political left and a political right, although not necessarily exactly parallel to what occurs in North America, I would say more closely aligned to Western Europe. And what Begin did to the religious parties is now, by the paradox of history, being revisited on the Likud. What do I mean by this particular statement? Again, let me go to an anecdote, a historical anecdote, about the area that I live, the area of Gush Etzion, where Rabbi Shorlo lives, although his Efrat is not part of our regional council. During the in the late 90s, Yuli Edelstein, now the Minister for Diaspora Affairs and Communications, decided that he wanted to run for the chairmanship of the regional council. Gush Etzion, historically, is a bastion of religious Zionism, perhaps one of the beacons of religious Zionism, the sources of pride of religious Zionism. And I supported Edelstein because I thought that a hero of the Soviet Jewry movement, a person who was imprisoned for spreading Jewish education in the Soviet Union, was a symbolic leader who could show the openness of religious Zionism. The now defunct Hatzofeh paper, which was then the organ of the Religious Zionist Party, printed an article in support of his opponent and a telling remark that Edelstein is suspected of affiliation with the Likud. In other words, religious Zionists had to support their old party, and Edelstein was in effect a Trojan horse. Edelstein lost. He, however, received the compensation that after 1996 he became a government minister, which is a better job, which is an upgrade over being a regional council head. Now, fast forward to today, the outgoing chairman of the Gush Etzion Regional Council, Shaul Goldstein, outwardly a member of Likud, and he has just received a promotion to head the National Parks Authority that is under the control of the, in a ministry, the Ministry of Ecology, that is under the control of Likud. In other words, religious Zionists are forming the background, forming the backbone of the conservative pole in Israeli politics. And let me add one caveat at the start. I do not mean by any case to argue that the only legitimate choice for a religious committed Jew is to vote for a conservative party. I fully respect the positions religiously committed Jews who decide to vote otherwise. But if we are talking about a majority, even if we look at a party like Meimad that tried to present a center to left of center alternative within religious Zionism, its success rate is nothing to brag about, and that party has disappeared from Israeli politics. Okay, so we have now a situation that the elite of what would be considered the national camp, Hamachaneh HaLumi, in Israel, is increasingly being populated by religious Zionists. And we see religious Zionists rising with the fortunes of Likud and increasingly tying their fortunes with Likud. If we look at the people around Netanyahu, and this has been remarked by the Israeli press, there is a large number of Srugim. people with knitted kippot. A national security advisor, Yaakov Amidror, whom Haaretz was worried whether he would answer the telephone on Shabbat, as if in his long and illustrious military career he didn't have the opportunity of showing that he knew how to act in cases of pikuach nefesh and fulfilling his military duty. People who run Netanyahu's office, and most importantly, you have the largest contingent of religious Zionists in the Knesset are not in the other religious Zionist parties, but they are in Likud. And that includes women, which is, I think, a black mark on the established religious Zionist parties. In terms of the spokespersons for the nationalist view, if you go newspaper by newspaper, if you go to Yediot, it's Chagai Segel and Chanoch Dam. If you go to Maariv, it's Kalman Libeskind and Erel Segel. If you go to Haaretz, the tokens in Haaretz are religious Zionists. In other words, the backbone of the nationalist camp, the more conservative pole, is anchored by religious Zionists, as the Likud's original ideology, or the people who once were the chief spokespersons of the ideology, either die out or are getting older, like Moshe Arendt's, for may live 120 years, but you do not have secular Likud spokespersons who defend the Likud ideology. The Likud must increasingly enlist religious Zionists. Okay. Another factor that has strengthened the hand of religious Zionists and religion in general is the coalescing of the Netanyahu coalition of 1996. In 1996, Netanyahu beat Peres with what was called a coalition of the disaffected. Brit HaMenudim, people who were the outs in Israeli politics. And they were, after between 1992 and 1996, religious Zionists, Haredim, Russian immigrants, as well as the Likud. But this in 1999 was proven to be a fragile coalition. A coalition susceptible to attack by wedge issues. Perhaps the most famous slogan in the 1999 elections was the slogan in Russian of Sharansky's Yisrael Baaliyah party, MPD Pod Nash Control. We want the Ministry of the Interior in MPD in Russian has connotations back to the good old Soviet days when the MPD had all sorts of powers, including infamous ones. MPD Pod Nash Control and not Pod Shas control, not under the control of the Shas party. In other words, it was, you could drive a wedge between Russian immigrants and the Shas party, because there was also socio-economic friction. The Oriental Jews who saw themselves threatened by the newcomers in terms of occupational roles in Israeli society, and therefore it was easy for the left to drive a wedge in Netanyahu's coalition, and that wedge brought upon the downfall of that coalition. What has happened since is that, on the one hand, the Russian Jewish immigrants have become more acculturated, more accepted in Israeli society. And as opposed to the antagonism of 1999, in the last elections, you had a situation where Shas had to invest tremendous efforts at the final stages of the campaign against a threat to its vote. And who posed that threat? Avigdor Lieberman. Precisely the party that catered to Russian immigrants, who represented a sense of empowerment for, and obviously in his role of foreign minister, this is truly a sense of empowerment to immigrants from the former Soviet Union. They have arrived, but he and Shas now get along despite the campaign. And therefore, the wedge issues that formerly existed, I don't say that there aren't points of tension, I don't want to beautify the situation, but a coalition that was once very fragile and could be disrupted quite easily has solidified and become more stable. And since I understand that some of you will be listening to Gershon Gorenberg in one of the later sessions, precisely because the political arena has become unfavorable for the Israeli left, the second line of defense for the Israeli left, in order that the victories of the national camp at the ballot box will not be translated into policy, their second line of defense has become the institutions, and therefore, if you've been following the Israeli papers recently about what is going on in the debate over the Supreme Court, this represents the heart of the issue, where this second line of defense is currently under challenge. One of the founders of Italian communism, Antonio Gramsci, drew an important distinction between a party that was dominante, a party that was strong at the ballot box and could achieve electoral success, and a party that was dirigente, a party that had the moral and intellectual authority to mold public opinion and therefore start off with a cushion of legitimacy. And of course, the adverse side, a party that did not have a foothold in these institutions, started off with a negative cushion of illegitimacy. Now, these institutions in Israeli government and society are the judiciary, the senior civil service, and the media. Let me, since our time is limited, and I would like to at least give 10 minutes for questioning, let me refer to what is called the attack on democracy and the attack on the Supreme Court, because in my opinion, it's important that you should have an understanding of this. Should have an understanding of this issue. Up to 1980, the Israeli judiciary system operated with a sense of judicial restraint. It obviously intervened in cases of illegality, blatant illegality. It intervened in cases of arbitrariness, but it only intervened when there were cases of concrete injury to a particular citizen. It did not presume to be a substitute for governmental policy. With the rise of Likud, with the reversal of power in 1977, the Israeli Supreme Court has assumed a position of judicial activism in favor of what former Chief Justice Aaron Barak said, in favor of the enlightened public, meaning against the position of the unenlightened public. And three guesses: who fits the category of enlightened public and unenlightened public? There are legal issues that are enforced. There are legal issues such as violations on work on Shabbat, solicitation for prostitution, and perhaps one of the greatest threats to the Jewish identity of the State of Israel, and particularly coming from people who say, you know, we must withdraw in order to protect the Jewish identity of the State of Israel, the massive illegal immigration across Sinai from Africa, which in the past month has reached a total of 4,000 people. You see this in places like Eilat, you see them in Arad, and of course you see them in around the central bus station in Tel Aviv. For some reason, the rule of law is not enforced in these cases. You have a judiciary that in 1999, when Netanyahu closed the Orient House, which under the Camp David agreements was operating illegally in Jerusalem as a PLO headquarters, his decision was overturned by the Supreme Court on the grounds that Netanyahu had no right to do so during the elections. When we came around to the 2001 elections, and Barak, during the election campaign, was continuing negotiations with Arafat in order to clinch a deal prior to the elections, and on the same grounds, that decision was appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided not to intervene. If the time would have allowed us, I could go into further detail, but also it is a court that in the previous incarnation of the court of up to 1980, on an appointment, the court would decide whether there was corruption, illegality. Now the court decides on the grounds of plausibility. Whose plausibility? Not the plausibility of the government, the plausibility of the justice. In other words, there has been an attempt to shift power from the elected representatives of the people and move it over increasingly to the judiciary, coupled, and if we're talking about threats to democracy, coupled with a systemic delegitimation campaign against the Knesset, against elected officials, because they belong to the wrong side of the political spectrum. And therefore, the only people who can be entrusted with rulings are the members of the judiciary, who are selected by a sui generis process in the Western world, where the sitting justices are part of the judicial selection committee. And then, when attempts are made at changing that, they talk about separation of powers. However, to conclude my remarks, this second line of defense is now under attack. And again, the people who are being tapped as candidates to change the balance of the court are again religious Zionists, whether it's Noam Solberg of Alon Shvut or District Court Justice Noam Solberg or District Court Justice Dvorah Berliner. The people who are going to supply the elite in an alternation of power system, which Israel has become, are increasingly drawn from the religious Zionist camp. Now, this is, on the one hand, a tribute. On the other hand, it is also a responsibility. And when power, if this trend continues and power is thrust upon religious Zionism, we can only hope that we will exercise it responsibly and successfully. Okay, I'm going to open the floor to questions. Yes? The lady, yeah.
Thank you.
Look, first of all, I don't subscribe to the original premise of religious fundamentalism in Judea and Samaria. This is a very useful formula to say that if you've adopted a position on the diplomatic territorial issue, you are automatically a religious fundamentalist. I belong to a community where on the issue of women's rights, we have women giving the drashot. We're not going to reach an egalitarian service, at least during my lifetime. But I would say that on balance, the communities in Judea and Samaria do not present a threat of a theocratic rule. On the other hand, Israel does not have a constitution. It has basic laws. One of them is in terms of basic liberties. And if you have a court that is going to adjudicate on these laws, then you have to have justices who are selected by the executive and the legislature in order to reflect changes in terms of political trends. They also have to adjudicate on the law, the lex lata, the law that is before us, not the lege ferenda, not the law that they would like it to be. And the ultimate repository of what that law is the legislative branch. We have a crazy situation in that when the Knesset tries to pass a law reversing a decision of the Supreme Court, it is described as a kvish okef bagatz, a path that constitutes a sort of illegal detour of the Supreme Court. But this is exactly how the British system, which we've inherited, works. If you do not like a court decision or a court interpretation of the law, then it is the right of the legislative branch to clarify what it means by that law. If the courts are going to decide on moral and religious issues, then they have to be selected by the executive and legislative branch and not replicated by the sitting court justices.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your analysis. It seems to me that if your hypothesis that Likud is essentially a resurgent Mafdal, so to speak, that the danger for the Jewish polity of the country could be impaired, because the natural consequence would be for the parties of the center-left to ally with the Haredi parties who are willing to abscond a national agenda in return for their economic wishes. If you wish, a non-ideological, pragmatic Haredi party, Beitar Elit perhaps, is a community who are willing to give up, if you wish, any national sentiment, as Mafdal did in the 50s, in return for receiving their agenda eternally. And for the Jewish agenda in the country, that is extremely divisive and dangerous.
Okay. It's a good point, and it addresses a point that I left out. When I spoke about the solidifying of the Netanyahu coalition, I left out the Haredim, and I should have definitely included them. The Haredim have also changed over 10 years. The Haredim are much more identified with the nationalist camp than they look, you have Rav Eliashiv, you have their leadership, but that leadership, he may, again, may live to 120 years, but he's 102. May definitely enjoy Chai. But the Haredi camp has become more acculturated. First of all, we're talking about a new generation that is less defensive. The first generation of Haredim were in a state of siege against the alien state. Now, and I see this in my own relations, where the first generation who weren't Haredi from birth, or who had just managed to come and were trying to rebuild a Haredi Jewish life, they were very defensive and very apprehensive. Now you have a Haredi generation. Again, I'm speaking in generalizations, and you probably could find support from your position in some cases, like I can find support for my reading. But by my reading, the increase in the army service, it used to be that Netzach Yehuda, the military detachment that attracted Haredim, used to attract the misfits, the Shababnikim, the people who otherwise would have descended to even worse situation aside from leaving religious observance. Now, you find it increasingly popular because of the fact that welfare benefits have been cut. You have an increasing number of Haredim entering the workforce and seeking higher education. You had, here, this is and in the United States, Britain, it's taken for granted that they will be in the workforce. In Israel, it worked the other way. But now, in the last Bar Association elections, you had a Haredi list. Therefore, they have become closer, and the idea of a pragmatic Haredi party interested purely in sectoral interests, abandoning, jumping ship in order to secure a great deal with the left, or as the late Ezer Weizman said, Shulamit Aloni would be willing to put on a shtreimel in order to have the Haredim vote for her. No, I'm a shtreimel. Shaitel, sichata tzedek. Tzedala tikuna Rav Charles. Thank you for the correction. But she would have also even put on the shtreimel on top of the shaitel in order to get their support. Okay, I realize we have 5 minutes. And therefore, that option is being rapidly foreclosed. Now, I'm not saying that I definitely realize the fear of cutting off the left, and it's definitely from and making them antagonistic. But again, if we look at examples from Western Europe, if the left, as in Germany, as in France, sees that without religious support they cannot return to power, they will make an effort to tone down an anti-clerical position. This is what the German Social Democratic Party did in Bad Godesberg. This is what Mitterrand did in the French Socialist Party. It is simply something that is part of the electoral market. I think we have time for two more questions. Yes, ma'am. Okay. With permission of the higher authorities, we have three questions that I can see. Yeah.
In your most lucid presentation, you left out the battle for the army. I think that's one of the more important institutions in Israel. And based on the Israel Hayom today, there's now a statement made that soldiers should be prepared to die rather than to hear Kol Isha. Now that comes from a Hesder Rosh Yeshiva. The whole battle for the soul of the army, I think, is equal to the Supreme Court and all the other institutions. I'd like you to comment on that, please.
Look, in terms of Rabbi Levanon, in terms of issues of halakha, I would much rather have Rabbi Sherlo answer the question than myself. I would have no problems with hearing female soldiers singing. I disagree with you in terms of the relative power of the army versus the Supreme Court. I think the Supreme Court is still a more dominant institution in shaping Israeli life. The army is what worries the left about the increasing prominence of religious Zionists is the fact that after people have been major generals or perhaps even a chief of staff, then they go into politics, then they go into major jobs. And again, you have the case of people like Boogie Yalon, Dayan, people who weren't religious, being attracted to think tanks started by religious Zionists, either Shalem or the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. So I agree with you that it's an important area. It's an area that we should be very hesitant not to, I disagree with the position, not just out of political opportunism, but I disagree with it in principle. But we should be very careful in that regard. Yeah.
Can you just talk a little bit about you talked about how the Haredim are seeing the religious Zionists. What is the religious Zionist attitude towards government stipends to kollels and supporting that system in Israel?
Fair question. All right. Look, I'll deal with our view. The religious Zionist view, obviously, is that only in the cases of a religious elite is there a justification for a kollel system. It's obviously not the choice for the majority. The position should be Torah Avodah. And therefore, despite what you're going to hear from the welfare protesters, the cuts in the welfare system, including to the kollelim, basically work in favor of that direction. In other words, there will be sufficient funds for an elite, which was the original basis of Ben-Gurion's agreement with the Haredi camp, also in Ben-Gurion's belief that the Haredis would die out, they would disappear from the scene. And therefore, the position is that it should be for a religious elite and the most talented people, and the rest get a job.